Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. This week, we're looking at the life of a man who nearly became suffocated by his own creation, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories. He died in 1930, and there are just two recordings of him. Let's listen to a little of one of them.
With regard to Sherlock Holmes, I was, when I wrote it, a young doctor, and had been educated in a very severe and critical medical school of thought, especially coming under the influence of Dr. Bell of Edinburgh, who had most remarkable powers of observation. He prided himself that when he looked at a patient, he could tell not only their disease, but very often their occupation and place of residence. Reading some detective stories, I was struck by the fact that their results were obtained in nearly every case by chance. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance. The result was Sherlock Holmes.
My guest, who's chosen Conan Doyle, is the broadcaster, author, raconteur, presenter, master of ceremonies, and former MP, Giles Brandreth. Giles, you've not only read the Sherlock Holmes stories, you've effectively written some of your own, haven't you?
I've been writing a series of Victorian murder mysteries featuring Arthur Conan Doyle and Oscar Wilde as my Holmes and Watson. But my interest in Conan Doyle really began with, of course, Sherlock Holmes. I was brought up in London in the 1950s. My parents lived in a mansion flat in Baker Street. And as a child, I literally looked out of my bedroom window onto what was considered to be 221B Baker Street. So as a small boy, not only did I read all the Sherlock Holmes stories and fall in love with them, I felt I knew the man. I felt at night, out of my window, I could see the window of his apartment. I could almost see his silhouette. But then I was sent away to boarding school. And the boarding school I was sent to was a place called Beedale's. First play I put on there was called A Study in Sherlock. It was a play about Sherlock Holmes. The boy actor then, a boy at school with me, called Simon Cadell, later became a well-known actor. He played Sherlock Holmes, was definitive. But I discovered at this school that one of the former pupils of the school had been the children of Oscar Wilde. And I became interested in Oscar Wilde. I forgot about Sherlock Holmes until a few years later, when I happened to be reading the autobiography of Arthur Conan Doyle to find out more about him, when I discovered that Oscar Wilde and Arthur Conan Doyle had become friends. And I thought, this is such an unlikely conjunction of people. Who was Arthur Conan Doyle? And I became fascinated by this character. And I think Conan Doyle is everything that I am not. But as the years go by, I think he is more and more what I would like to be.
Interesting, because as we were listening to that voice, I was thinking, oh, so that's how Sherlock Holmes spoke. And I had to stop myself. No, it's not Sherlock Holmes. It's Conan Doyle, the author.
Well, this, of course, was the great problem for Arthur Conan Doyle, is that he became synonymous with Sherlock Holmes. The confusion was great. People used to write to 221B Baker Street. I mean, literally, sackloads of letters came to Sherlock Holmes. It was, for him, as it were, one of the blights of it. It was both the making of Conan Doyle and the curse of his life, Sherlock Holmes.
Also with us is Conan Doyle's biographer, Andrew Lycett, who was also our expert witness when we covered Conan Doyle's contemporary, Rudyard Kipling. Andrew, Conan Doyle, once he was successful, was very much the Edwardian clubman, wasn't he? He knew Kipling, he knew Wilde, as Giles has been saying, he knew Jerome K. Jerome, P.G. Woodhouse, Winston Churchill. Was he, in fact, an establishment figure or an outsider?
No, he wasn't really. He was born in Edinburgh in 1859. He was the son of two Irish parents, or people of Irish extraction. You hear in that funny voice that we heard at the beginning, it's not quite Scottish. It's kind of, it's often described as Northumbrian burr that he concocted for himself. He developed through the English public school system, went to Edinburgh University, studied to be a doctor, and became a GP in Portsmouth. He always wanted to write. So there was sort of two sides to his personality. There was the sort of practical, scientific one, the one that had been trained medically, and there's also the great imagination. And, you know, you have those two sides warring with each other.
The first surprise about Conan Doyle, I think, is that we see him, if you see a photograph of him, you see quite a stocky man in tweeds with a moustache. You imagine him with a cane, you imagine him being a burly person.
15 stone, apparently.
And an establishment figure. Mm. And yet, when you begin to, the first surprise is to find that his youth and his childhood is very difficult indeed. His father is a drinker. His mother is downtrodden. His early life is, I think, full of hardship. And what I find curious about this man is that I admire him so much, and yet he's so unlike, I think, probably you and me, Matthew, in that he's a great sportsman. Mm. Football he loves, cricket he loves, golf he loves. He's gung-ho. He's wanting to be out there doing all these things, and at the same time, he wants to be an intellectual. He's got to have it all, hasn't he?
Is it true that he and Kipling actually introduced golf to America?
Not actually introduced, but when he actually was quite successful, he just sort of laid Sherlock Holmes aside for the first time, and he went to America on a lecture tour, and he went to visit the great writer Rudyard Kipling, who was married to an American and living in Vermont. Conan Doyle, being the sportsman, he had his golf clubs with him. They went out onto the sort of rolling hill land outside Kipling's house, and they played a round of golf. I've actually seen the card of it.
When does he go on the first of his great adventures? Is it before he goes to Edinburgh or after? He goes and serves on a whaler, I think.
Yes, somewhere. That is actually when he goes as a sort of ship's doctor up to the Arctic.
He had physical courage and wanted to exert it. He wanted to do things that involved danger.
He didn't like being a doctor very much, did he? He set up in Portsmouth, was it, Andrew?
Indeed, South Sea, in fact. But all the time, he wanted to write. He started writing stories for the sort of magazines that were around at the time, Blackwood's magazine, trying different genres, trying a bit of mystery, a bit of ghost stories. And suddenly in 1886, he alights on another genre, which is just something that he wants to have a go at, the detective story.
And even with this first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, mm-hmm. he doesn't hit the jackpot immediately. Off it goes. It is published.
It's rejected a couple of times.
It's rejected a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And eventually it comes into print. He's satisfied. He moves on. And we wouldn't have had any more Sherlock Holmes stories had it not been for this dinner that took place only a few hundred yards from where we are sitting now. We are in Langham Place in London at Old Broadcasting House, and across the way, before this building was built, was the Langham Hotel. And there, one evening in August 1889, an American publisher invited young writers who he hoped would write for his new magazine, Lippincott's Monthly Magazine. And the two young writers he invited to dinner were Oscar Wilde, who was by then fairly established as a writer, though not as a playwright, and the young Arthur Conan Doyle, who'd written only a handful of published stories. And as a result of that evening, essentially, Oscar Wilde was persuaded to write what became The Picture of Dorian Gray, and Arthur Conan Doyle was persuaded to write a second murder mystery, the second Sherlock Holmes story, The Sign of Four. So it was a momentous night.
To which you have unveiled a plaque, apparently.
Apparently. I don't know how you could have missed it, but yes, on the Langham Hotel there is now a plaque commemorating what I think was a historic literary encounter between these two unlikely people.
Andrew, you mentioned him trying his hand quite early on at ghost stories. Talk a little bit about the spiritualism.
Right.
At what stage in Conan Doyle's life does this interest develop into the near obsession that it became?
In 1882, the Society for Psychical Research was set up, and that was exactly the date that Conan Doyle arrived in Southsea in Portsmouth. It was a time that people were doing seances, and he took a scientific interest in it. And this is what the Society for Psychical Research was about, in fact. You know, it was in that period just after Darwin, the end of God, if you know, some people say, etc. And, you know, people were a bit sort of agitated about this, and they thought that science could prove it.
It's an important point that Andrew makes, that Conan Doyle approached this not as some kind of a religious mystic, not in a poetic way, but as a scientist, as a doctor.
As a doctor, and also it was something that everybody was doing. He wasn't alone. It wasn't eccentric to be doing it in the way that he was doing it. He was a scientist. He was probing it. Later, he felt he came up with the answers. But at this early stage, it's simply something in which he is intrigued.
Well, now, talking of other worlds and contact with spirits from the dead, let's lay our cards on the table here, Giles Brandreth. I think it's all complete garbage. Conan Doyle obviously thought there might be, and in the end thought there was something in it. What do you think?
I don't know. My feeling, I've become so devoted to Arthur Conan Doyle, to be honest, that if he is hearing voices from the other side, I'm ready to. But of course, it is bunkum. And I know one of the reasons, apart from his scientific interest, was the human situation. He lived at a time when war was everywhere. He travelled out to the Boer War in South Africa because he wanted to be there. He felt he was a bit old for it by then, but he volunteered to be there as a medical orderly. If he couldn't be there as a doctor, he would be there in some capacity. When the Great War came along, he saw so many of the children of his generation being killed in that war. His own brother, at the end of the First World War, dies in the flu epidemic after the war. Many of his wife's family are killed in the First World War. So there is that yearning to... Has it all been wasted? Where have these people gone? And he wants to inquire more. Of course, he believes the unbelievable.
He was rather credulous. Tell us about the Cottingley fairies.
Right, indeed. This came after the First World War. He was told about these two young girls in Yorkshire who'd photographed fairies. And he was determined that this would be true. And he went up and investigated. He saw the photographs. And he put out a little booklet that said that, you know, this was true. It was part of his desire to show that there was a scientific basis to spiritualism. And he did it in all sorts of different ways in that period.
Can I say something? The Cottingley Fairies, it's a charming photograph. And in fact, so charming is it, I have a copy of the photograph framed and at home.
Don't tell me you believe in the Cottingley Fairies.
Well, to be honest, if Arthur Conan Doyle is ready to believe in fairies, then perhaps so am I. Before we, as it were, dismiss him as a credulous and naive man, the reason that he got so far with this is because of the authority he had.
I think that by that period, I have to just say something here, Giles, that he wasn't quite the figure of authority that he had been back in the 1890s. And why I say that is that he'd wanted to write the official history of the First World War. And people had sort of kept him at arm's length because they thought that, you know, he was a bit past it. And he did a sort of his own history, very detailed history, but it wasn't the official history. And that rather sort of preyed on him.
Is this the point, Matthew, where we should bring in the question of his first wife and his second wife? I think this is key to him. I regard this man as having had a great life, in part because he has created one of the great characters of all fiction. And where we get a little bit troubled is when we get down to the question of his wife. His first wife, who went under the nickname Tui, I think her name was Louisa, she had frail health quite early on in the marriage and had to spend a lot of time, I think, in sanatoria or certainly in a climate where...
She had tuberculosis and he took her to live up in Hindhead at this house that he built there called Undershaw. And the idea was that there was healthy air up there in Surrey.
But he only married her after failing to save her brother's life, as I understand. Is that right?
That is true, yeah. Brother came to him when he was a GP in South Sea, and he actually took the brother in and tried to look after the brother, but failed. He got to know the young Louisa.
Yes, and then marries the sister, you know, rather indecently, briefly after the death of the
brother. That's right.
The brother. Then, I mean, is this the action of a gentleman, Giles?
Well, this is the question that we do have to ask because, and I'm hoping that Andrew's going to help us on this, he has this frail wife. As I understand it, he looks after and looks after her well and is devoted to her. But in the 1890s, he meets a younger woman and does he or does he not fall in love with her?
He certainly falls in love with her.
Now, we know that, do we?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. There's a story when, just after coming back from the Boer War, Conan Doyle took his young mistress to Lord's cricket ground. And his brother-in-law, Hornung, saw him there and was appalled that he should be walking out.
You call her his mistress. Mm. I don't think she was technically his mistress, if by that you mean the act of darkness had taken place. Did he not have, as it were, a fixation with this younger woman, about which he did very little except, as it were, heavy flirtation until his wife died?
It's one of those things that
one cannot really
say. But the fact is that, as was discovered just before I wrote my biography, that the 1901 census came out and Conan Doyle was discovered to be in a hotel in Forest Row on the edge of Ashdown Forest with Jean Leckie, as she then was.
Yes. How do you feel about this, Giles?
Well, I think it is quite complicated, because one of the reasons that I choose Conan Doyle as a great life is because my gut feeling is here is somebody who has physical courage, intellectual courage. He dares to believe in things that are unpopular. He also is a great creator of a wonderful character. But more than that, he plays a part in public life. He does the decent thing when the decent thing is to be done. For example, he takes on two lost causes, people who have been prosecuted and he believes wrongly. He reads about this and drives it through. He's a great champion of the good. And so I'm disappointed to find, as it were, that he was, as men are, not necessarily all, Matthew, Andrew, I know there are exceptions. Now, funny that we all three should be in the same studio on the same day. But men are frail, and it's slightly disappointing to find that he had a wife who was sickly, and, you know, as well as nursing his wife, he was, you know, playing the field.
I think that you have to bear in mind that he did care for his wife, Louise, you know, as much as he could. But he fell in love with this younger woman.
All the while, the writing was going very well, and he was becoming very highly regarded and quite wealthy as an author. But he was incredibly prolific. He did all sorts of different things. He must have wondered at some points in his life, and I wonder whether you've wondered too, Giles, whether it wouldn't have been better if he'd just concentrated on one thing. I mean, look at everything that you've done. You came out of university as a young writer, you churned stuff out, puzzle books, journalism for women's magazines, theatrical biographies, books of party games, plays, joke books. Have you ever thought, why don't I just slow down and concentrate on one thing?
When did my wife phone you to put this thought into your head? The difference, of course, is this, that Arthur Conan Doyle created Sherlock Holmes. But he suffered the frustration that any of these writers did. A.A. Milne hated the fact that all he was remembered for was Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh. J.M. Barrie, the frustration, all they ever want to talk about is Peter Pan. Charles Dodgson, I've heard enough of Alice. This is the price they pay when they create this extraordinary one character. He was constantly questing to do other things.
He got so fed up, Giles, with people just wanting to talk about Holmes, that in the end he killed Holmes off, didn't he?
Well, he wanted, first of all, to kill him off quite early on. Mm. And it was only the intervention of his mother, to whom he was devoted. I mean, his mother wrote to him and said, you dare murder Holmes, and everyone will want to murder you. So he stood back. Eventually he does kill off Holmes, and then is obliged a few years later to bring him back, both because of public demand and because he needed the money. The truth is, the stories do get thinner as the years go by, but because it's Sherlock Holmes, we buy into it nonetheless.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Giles Brandreth, has chosen the life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and our expert is Conan Doyle's biographer, Andrew Lycett. He also ran to be a Member of Parliament twice.
He was a Liberal Unionist, yeah, in fact. And, you know, he actually sort of started getting into politics in Portsmouth, supporting Balfour against Gladstone. But, you know, definitely had this, you know, radical streak.
He wrote a magnificent book about Belgian atrocities in the Congo.
Indeed. And also he was president of the Divorce Law Reform Association, which you wouldn't really associate with him. So there was that mixture of liberal instincts. I mean, he took up the cause of a half-past-C chap in Staffordshire who had been accused of maiming animals. And Conan Doyle proved that this fellow had astigmatism and couldn't have actually seen to do what he was supposed to have done. And Julian Barnes wrote his best-selling book, Arthur and George, about this particular case.
What I think is intriguing about Conan Doyle is here we have somebody who begins life as a young doctor. He wants to do good as a young doctor. He finds, as he does it, it's much more frustrating than he thought. People don't come to his practice in the way that he hoped they would. He goes out on this whaler to be a doctor at sea. That's more exciting for him. He feels maybe he should specialise. He goes to study ophthalmology in Vienna. All this questing in different directions, never quite finding his métier. He begins writing, and he has to write a whole range of different things, never quite settling on which one he likes most.
That's what your wife was telling me, Charles.
And I'm beginning now to warm to your mutual theme. And then he decides to become a politician. Yes. Because he wants to change the world. And he isn't a party politician. Though, as you say, he was a liberal unionist, he wasn't a party man. He was somebody who believed in different causes and wanted to take it forward. So there he is with all this energy, throwing it in every different direction. But at the same time, I think at root we have this very attractive... Was he good company? One of the things that I found intriguing, when I began to write my novels about Oscar Wilde and Arthur Conan Doyle, I thought this is an unlikely duo of people. But clearly they liked one another. And was he good company? I get the impression that he was rather good
company. I think he definitely was. I mean, he was the man that, you know, the word clubbable could have been invented for. You know, initially starting off associated with the people around Jerome K. Jerome, the Idlers Club, then sort of graduating through the Reform Club. Eventually, you know, in his later years, very conventional, the Athenaeum. And then there was, of course, his sporting interests. And I think you mentioned cricket, but there was boxing, all sorts of sporting things.
He played football for Portsmouth Football Club. I mean, when he put the gloves on and he fought.
Yeah, and he played first-class cricket. And another, his...
And introduced skiing to Switzerland, somebody told me.
That's a bit like he introduced golf to the United States. No, he didn't introduce skiing to Switzerland. But he liked to ski and he went to Davos. And that was actually one of the places that he liked to take his first wife, Louisa. I mean, one aspect of him that we haven't talked about is that he actually wrote poetry. Not very good poetry, but I just love his little poem about when he managed to get W.G. Grace out in a cricket game. The first verse goes, "Once in my heyday of cricket, oh day I shall ever recall, I captured that glorious wicket, the greatest of all."
He, as you can see, had a romantic streak to him, which I find very, very attractive indeed.
Let's come back to the spiritualism and listen to another clip of Conan Doyle speaking.
"I've always, of course, kept my mind open to new ideas. For the day a man's mind shuts is the day of his mental death. In 1887, some curious psychic experiences came my way. And especially, I was impressed by the fact of telepathy, which I proved for myself by experiments with a friend. The question then arose, if two incarnate minds could communicate, is it possible for a discarnate one to communicate with one that is still in the body? For more than 20 years, I examined the evidence and came finally to the conclusion beyond all doubt that such communication was possible."
What were these experiences in 1887? Do either of you know?
Well, he did some seances initially, and also he was trying to communicate telepathically, as people did at the time. You know, he met with two or three like-minded people in Portsmouth. Now, this was what he was trying to do. At the same time, he was communicating with the early scientific researchers into psychical research. He actually wrote to something that's associated with that called Light magazine. And later on, of course, he became the international president of the Association of Spiritualists or whatever it was. He was a great international spiritualist.
And he became almost obsessive about it, I think, as the years went by, partly because, you know, 1,000 and more people turned up when he came to speak, and they cheered him on, and so he believed his own message.
Into his life, towards the end, comes this character, Phineas. Encouraged by his wife, Jean, she had developed mediumship powers. She summoned up a spirit guide, who was called Phineas, who was an Arabian from Ur, before the age of Abraham, who proved useful as an estate agent. because Jean's Phineas took them to a little cottage in the New Forest, which Phineas told Jean was the right place for them to live. Indeed. So Jean found the spiritualism quite useful in that respect.
I think that Jean was quite sort of influential in encouraging him to take on spiritualism in quite the way that he did.
What Jean was able to share with him was the interest in spiritualism. She was also, as it were, in the driving seat when it came to spiritualism. Mm. When he was a writer, he was writing alone. She had nothing to contribute there. But when he was being on his spiritualist bandwagon, she was there urging him on. So there they were a team. And it was part of, I think, her power over him was in this particular area.
Do you think that towards the end of his life he was reconciled with those two cuckoos in his career nest, Watson and Holmes?
Yes, I think in the end, if you... I got to know about his life simply by reading his autobiography that he wrote in the 1920s. And by then he's settled. He's an older man and he's accepting what his place in the world is. He is the man who created Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. He knows that's going to be his destiny. At the same time, he tells us, you think that's going to be my destiny, but I have to tell you, I have discovered the truth about the other world, the spiritual dimension, and in time you will be remembering me for things other than the occupants of 221B Baker Street. Well, time is not over. He may prove to be right yet. In the meantime, we still have got those matchless Sherlock Holmes stories.
Do you think, a final question, Giles, that were his spirit, and perhaps his spirit is presiding over this conversation, the spirit will be disappointed that we're treating rather lightly the question of psychic connections and spiritualism, and sorry that the world and scientific thought didn't go the way that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle thought they were going to go?
In some ways, after our half hour together, Matthew, I'm feeling a bit disconcerted about him, to be honest with you. I think when I read his autobiography, I sort of fell in love with this man. I thought, here is somebody who's created a character that has been part of my life since I was a little boy. And reading about him, I thought, here is somebody who has been heroic. He's taken up lost causes. He's believed in something we don't believe in, but he's followed it through. He's had intellectual courage, physical courage. He is a great man. That was my feeling about him. And as we have talked, hearing about him in relation to his first wife who was ill while he fell in love with another woman, hearing about, yes, his credulity over the Cottingley fairies, I have seen, as it were, his feet of clay. And in a way, I don't want to remember them. I go down to look at his grave, and on his gravestone are the words, "Blade straight, steel true, Arthur Conan Doyle." And that is my Conan Doyle, and it clearly isn't the whole picture. And I just have to accept that. And I'll forgive everything, really, because whatever else he did, he created Sherlock Holmes.
My thanks to Giles Brandreth, who's chosen the life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and to Conan Doyle's biographer, Andrew Lycett. Goodbye. Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.